Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents When Germs Travel, Six Major Epidemics That Have Invaded America, and the Fears They Have Unleashed, by Howard Markle, narrated by Stephen J. Cohen. Introduction. And if a stranger sojourn with thee in your land, you shall not vex him, but the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Leviticus, chapter 19, verses 33 through 34. Infectious disease is one of the great tragedies of living things, the struggle for existence between different forms of life. Man sees it from his own prejudiced point of view, but clams, oysters, insects, fish, flowers, tobacco, potatoes, tomatoes, fruit, shrubs, trees, have their own varieties of smallpox, measles, cancer, or tuberculosis. Incessantly, the pitiless war goes on, without quarter or armistice, a nationalism of species against species. Hans Zinsser, M.D., Rats, Lice, and History. Our struggle against deadly microbes is endless. Scourges that have plagued human beings since the ancients still threaten to unleash themselves. New maladies are brewing that have yet to make their appearance in the headlines. Some germs kill rapidly. Others are able to live within their hosts for lengthy periods, causing chronic disease. Regardless of their mode of attack or cohabitation, microbes exist solely to multiply, thrive, and find new hosts. The most egalitarian of living organisms, they cross all national boundaries and every social class, attacking without prejudice. Simply put, germs travel. Not surprisingly, human beings are among the most common vectors of epidemic disease. As humans travel, so too do the infections we may harbor. Increasingly, globalization, social upheaval, and international travel renders us all potential inhabitants of the so-called hot zone. How ironic, then, that the United States, a country which has prided itself since inception on being a nation of immigrants, continues its lengthy tradition of blaming newcomers for many of its physical and social ills. Today, more than two-thirds of all Americans are either immigrants themselves or the children or grandchildren of immigrants. The experiences of moving great distances from one nation and culture to another, anxieties over adapting to the American way of life, and stigmatization because of one's foreign appearance, accent, or manners are still fresh memories or everyday realities for many millions of newcomers who have made America their home. Still, the association of immigrants with imported infections remains, and stories of their journeys, illnesses, and treatment reveal much about our predispositions for dealing with the perceptual threat of contagious disease. In the fall of 2001, a few weeks after the tragedy of September 11th, I wrote these words for the first edition of this book. Sadly, the report card on how we have dealt with pandemics and epidemics is not a good one. We failed at the start of this century, and we're failing again. In less than 18 years, we have endured six international contagion crises. Global authorities were caught flat-footed by the first of these, SARS, or Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, in 2002 through 2003. Harsh lessons from those missteps informed better responses to avian, aka bird, H5N1 influenza in 2005, the H1N1 influenza pandemic of 2009, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, epidemic in 2012, and to some extent, the Ebola virus epidemic in West Africa in 2016. Looming larger than all of those is the COVID-19 pandemic of 2020. both here and abroad, the lessons of past contagion crises have been ignored, with starkly tragic results. COVID-19 is a newly emerging virus from the same family of microbes that caused SARS and MERS in Jordan and the Arabian Peninsula in 2012, and Korea in 2015. These coronaviruses are zoonotic infections, meaning they jumped from animals to humans and mutated along the way to become easily transmissible. In COVID-19's case, it probably came from horseshoe bats, purchased and consumed at wet markets in Wuhan, China, just as SARS probably emerged from the consumption of civets butchered and consumed at the Guangdong wet markets. MERS, on the other hand, is related to close contact with camels or the consumption of camel milk. Epidemics are living social laboratories. They provide windows on the resilience and efficiency of a particular society's governmental structures, its social strengths and shortcomings, and its engagement with rumor, suspicion, or outright bad behavior. These events typically unfold dramatically and contain elements of discovery, reaction, suspense, conflict, illness, perhaps death, and one hopes, resolution. After all, epidemics are hardly quiet occasions. They are experienced and responded to in real time by the affected community, only to be later rediscovered, heralded, and explained by historians. Since the post-World War II years in particular, with the advent of miraculous antibiotics and preventative vaccines, it looked to many as if the ultimate victory against these microbial armies was imminent. Accompanying such delusions of victory has been a collective underestimation of the remarkable and highly unpredictable power of infection. As we see, with each return of a seriously contagious epidemic, be it naturally induced or man-made, germs still have the ability to incite panic. Some have likened this relationship to a war between the species. I prefer to see it as an enduring dance among living beings, in which the leading partner often changes with the passage of time. But the interactions of microbes and human beings demand far more than precise language to describe them. We require a different strategy for how we approach all health problems facing the world today. Over the past century, sophisticated means of international public health surveillance and disease control have developed through experienced trial and error. Nevertheless, these programs are expensive and tend to be underfunded because, paradoxically, public health and preventative medicine measures are silent by definition. If they are working well, few outbreaks of disease occur, and those that do are contained quickly. This success, in turn, engenders public apathy or overconfidence that the pitiless war, so nicely articulated by Hans Zinsser in 1935, has been won rather than stayed temporarily. Today, too many of us discount the value of public health programs, and given the ease and pace of international travel, dangerous microbes stand a better chance of gaining dominance. In When Germs Travel, I tell six stories about immigrants who traveled to the United States during the 20th century and were blamed for importing deadly epidemics. They illustrate universal truths about the enduring relationship between pathogenic, disease-causing microbes and human beings, and between the sick and those charged with protecting them, as well as the healthy population. Taken together, these historical narratives demonstrate how we vacillate between demanding a strict and protective public health system and one that is too lax or underfunded, and between our fascination with all things infectious to hardly giving microbes a second thought. They also document our national foible of blaming contagious woes on others. These questions have become far more than academic in our new era of plague. As the COVID-19 crisis has unfolded with such drastic effects, I felt as if I were living in one of my own history books. It cannot be emphasized enough that the COVID-19 pandemic is a direct result of our ability to travel anywhere on the planet in a matter of hours. On March 10, 2020, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Democrat of Michigan, declared a state of emergency in my home state in response to the pandemic. One day later, my university's president ordered an unprecedented shutdown of the entire academic enterprise. At the time, I was teaching my undergraduate class on literature and medicine. As coincidence would have it, we were knee-deep in the course's unit on epidemics and making our way through such classics as Henrik Ibsen's 1882 drama of a public health emergency in a small Norwegian town, An Enemy of the People, Catherine Ann Porter's 1939 short story collection on the 1918 influenza pandemic, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, Sinclair Lewis's 1925 Pulitzer Prize novel of medical research and infectious disease, Arrowsmith, William Carlos Williams' collection on his experiences as a physician, The Doctor's Stories, and Larry Kramer's 1985 play about the early years of the AIDS pandemic, The Normal Heart. None of these literary works, as brilliant as they are, hold a candle to Albert Camus' The Plague, La Peste. Published in 1947, the novel is partly an allegory to the French resistance during World War II and human reactions to the absurd. Yet, as medical historian Charles Rosenberg has pointed out so brilliantly, the novel is, bar none, the best qualitative study of an epidemic as a social phenomenon ever written. Every year I read and teach this novel, and I walk away from the experience in absolute wonder at how Camus got everything about an epidemic so flawlessly. Its lessons in four acts serve as the perfect introduction for the book you are about to read. The first act of Camus' The Plague is one of eye-opening events. The citizens of Oran first begin to acknowledge an increasing number of cases and deaths resulting from the spread of bubonic plague. Camus demonstrates this pattern with one of the most memorably disgusting opening scenes in all of literature. When leaving his surgery on the morning of April 16th, Dr. Bernard Rioux felt something soft under his foot. It was a dead rat lying in the middle of the landing. On the spur of the moment, he kicked it to one side and, without giving it a further thought, continued on his way downstairs. Only when he was stepping out into the street did it occur to him that a dead rat had no business to be on his landing, and he turned back to ask the concierge of the building to see to its removal. In this book, Dr. Rioux finds many more dead rats along the streets of Oran, but it takes a great deal of hectoring, cajoling, lecturing, and perhaps most critical when chasing after an epidemic, precious time, to convince his fellow townspeople that there is, in fact, a serious problem threatening the entire community. Sadly, slow acceptance and delayed courses of action in the face of contagious threats are all too common in the history of human epidemics. The second act centers on how the society responds to these seemingly random events and attempts to understand it. For example, there is a heated debate over the epidemic's origins between Dr. Rioux, who subscribes to a scientific bacteriological approach to understanding the plague, and the Catholic priest, Father Panelu, who at first believes that the plague is an act of divine retribution for sinful lifestyles and demands his parish to repent. This dichotomy in understanding infectious disease, with religion or morality on one hand and science on the other, is a hallmark of epidemics past and present. We must always account for how religious, spiritual, and cultural beliefs and practices can mitigate, contain, or inflame a contagion crisis. The third act details how the public demands that some type of action be taken to contain the spread of an epidemic, treat the ill, and manage the mounting death rate. And yet, There is always a tug of war between the public and those charged with protecting their health, because the operative word in public health is public. Leaders, therefore, must develop a strong public consensus on a plan of action that takes into account varying cultural values and attitudes, social and class hierarchies, as well as economic and political imperatives or ideologies. The final act is most vexing, especially for those involved in protecting the public's health. Epidemics often end as ambiguously as they appear. Specifically, once an epidemic peters out and susceptible individuals die, recuperate, or escape, life returns to its normal patterns. Too often, the conclusions of these episodes are flat and anticlimactic. Public health crises typically fade away not with a bang but a whimper, to borrow a phrase from T.S. Eliot. Most epidemics conclude with a return to the same set of social and public health circumstances that may have given rise to them in the first place. Albert Camus recorded this sense of global amnesia in the final sentences of his Contagious masterpiece. It is a mindset that threatens the world facing epidemics and pandemics to come. And indeed, as he listened to the cries of joy rising from the town, Rieu remembered that such joy is always imperiled. He knew what those jubilant crowds did not know, but could have learned from books, that the plague bacillus never dies or disappears for good, that it can lie dormant for years in furniture and linen chests, that it bides its time in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, and bookshelves, and that perhaps the day would come when, for the bane and the enlightening of men, it would rouse up its rats again and send them forth to die in a happy city. As we reflect on how drastically COVID-19 has changed all of our lives and will continue to do so, the final few sentences of Camus' The Plague may well represent one of the saddest and most eloquent endings in modern literature. If only it were on the pages of a novel where those unhappy lines unfolded. While hearing the following stories of contagion crises, the author hopes you will agree that there is a long list of contagious suspects to round up, be they infection-carrying rats, horseshoe bats, civets, and mosquitoes, to name but a few germy creatures, prideful governments that conceal brewing epidemics, globalization, climate change, or even politicians who deny an epidemic's very existence. They all represent the clear and present danger of life in the 21st century. The lesson, of course, is that we must act now to prevent or at least contain the next pandemic. I trust these tales illustrate universal truths about the enduring relationships between microbes and human beings, and between the sick and those charged with protecting the well. Taken together, the stories show how we vacillate between demanding a public health system so punitive that it worsens matters rather than protects, and settling for one that is too lax, and between being fascinated with all things infectious to hardly giving microbes a second thought. 1. Facing tuberculosis. For me, the awful, almost physically painful loneliness began the minute I heard a young doctor utter the phrase TB as an explanation for my problems. 2 letters. Who would have thought that someone articulating so brief a phrase would have so much power to completely change your life? Abdul, an Ethiopian immigrant, reflecting on his initial diagnosis of tuberculosis. One afternoon, a month and a day after the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, I was in a crowded subway car making its way down Manhattan's Upper West Side, only 7 miles south of the 125th Street station, where the train was delayed temporarily. Rescue workers and firemen were searching through the rubble and carnage on September 11th, 2001. Yet, On the subway that afternoon and around the country, a different form of terror was on our minds. Directly above me, on both sides of the train, were bright posters advertising a new and improved detergent that eliminates 99.9% of all bacteria lurking in your clothing. Parenthetically, all soaps pretty much accomplish this task. Sitting next to me was a heavyset woman rubbing her hands over and over like some modern-day Lady Macbeth, only instead of washing off the blood of her royal rivals, she was slathering her hands with a pinkish-red antibacterial moisturizer, guaranteed to both soften the skin and rid you of nasty germs. Seated next to her were two older men who appeared to be breathing less deeply and far more rapidly than I suspected they might otherwise be doing. At the very end of the car was a young woman wearing a surgical mask and rubber gloves. If these signs were not enough to alert the casual observer to what was going on, all one had to do was glance at the newspapers many were reading. Every publication from the lowly tabloids to the august New York Times screamed the same headline in bold print: anthrax. Inside their pages were all the sordid details of the infection-laden letters sent earlier that week to Senator Tom Daschle and others. That very morning, an assistant to NBC anchorman Tom Brokaw, who received a similar missive in late September, was confirmed to have a bona fide case of cutaneous anthrax. In the weeks that followed, several more cases of anthrax popped up, some easily explained, such as those among the postal workers handling the tainted mail, and some not, such as the fatal case in an elderly woman from Connecticut, whose mail was, unluckily, mixed in with contaminated envelopes meant for others. And we all worried if the Pandora's box of germs that appeared to have been opened by terrorists would ever be closed. The sudden appearance of a frightening infectious agent was perhaps one of the few things that could have so successfully taken the nation's collective mind, albeit temporarily, off the stunning events at Ground Zero. Government officials searched to find the source of the infection, to the accompaniment of television pundits pointing fingers and calling our public health mechanisms inadequate. Sales of Cipro, one of several antibiotics effective against anthrax and by far the most expensive, went through the roof. Emergency rooms and clinics across the country were inundated with people wondering if every scrape, wheeze, or contact with something as harmless as the crumbs of a powdered sugar donut was an incipient case of anthrax. That the public would focus with a laser beam intensity on anthrax, a strange scourge that killed only a few in spectacular fashion, while paying little attention to the more common contagions that literally plague us on a daily basis, is a phenomenon hardly unique to our era. Healthy human beings frequently worry more about frightening, unexpected infections than about diseases we know all too well, such as tuberculosis, a disease that is slow and patient, relentless and effective, and year in, year out, sends millions to their graves. If the forces of evolutionary biology could have imbued the tuberculosis germ with the capacity to feel neglect, it was probably used to it by now. Today, more than 2 billion of the planet's 6 billion people are infected with a latent form of tuberculosis. In the United States alone, 10 to 15 million are infected with it. Of this multitude, at least 10% of them will go on to develop the active form of tuberculosis sometime during their lives. The period between latency, with no signs of disease at all except a positive TB skin test, and active illness can range from weeks to years after the microbe Mycobacterium tuberculosis settles into the human body. Much has to do with the health of the particular host, his nutritional status, living conditions, and the coexistence of other diseases. But when considering the many influences that enable the TB bacillus to transform good health to ill, it is wise to recall the French chemist and microbiologist Louis Pasteur's warning to respect the infinitely great power of the infinitely small. Every year, public health officials across the globe diagnose more than 8 million active cases of TB. These are the people who are most infectious to others. The sicker someone is with active TB, the greater the number of microbes in his or her body. And with every cough, shout, or breath, that individual becomes a more significant risk to the public health. The average person with active TB will infect 20 other people before he or she dies or is adequately treated. What surprises many is that during every 12-month period, about 3 million people die of tuberculosis, making it the leading infectious cause of death in the world today. In fact, more human beings will die of TB in our era than at any other point in recorded history. The disease, often referred to as the White Plague in deference to the infamous bubonic or Black Plague, typically strikes adults during their most productive years of life, ages 18 to 55. Fortunately, since the late 1940s, medicine has been blessed with a wide range of potent antibiotics that can treat TB, and in most cases, cure it. At the same time, these medicinal miracles have given rise to premature declarations of victory over tuberculosis, especially over the past decade. Public health specialists have grown concerned about the rise of multidrug-resistant strains of tuberculosis around the world. In layman's terms, this means that not only do we have deadly germs on our hands, but in at least 1 out of 10 cases, and far more in Asia, South America, and the former Soviet Union, the mycobacteria are resistant to the very menu of powerful drugs we have developed to enter and kill them. Only recently have we begun to recognize the folly of extensive funding cuts in tuberculosis surveillance and treatment programs, and the unintended consequences of not investing in the basic health care needs of the most impoverished citizens of the world. Moreover, with the rise of HIV/AIDS over the past 2 decades, there is now a significant population of immunocompromised individuals who are highly susceptible to TB and can potentially spread the disease like an uncontrollable wildfire. Major social upheavals during these years have also resulted in mass migration movements around the globe. Each of these factors has created the conditions the tubercle bacillus needs to thrive once again, inspiring the World Health Organization to classify tuberculosis as a global health emergency. My fellow subway passengers that afternoon may have been worried about the off chance of meeting an anthrax spore. A few may have been contemplating the risk of a terrorist delivery of smallpox virus or even the highly unlikely importation of Ebola virus. I was, and am, far more concerned about contracting TB. Few stories of tuberculosis demonstrate its unpredictability better than that of one of the immigrants I met in a professor's office near the New York Presbyterian Hospital Tuberculosis Clinic. Alejandro, a 50-year-old laborer who came to the United States illegally from Ecuador in 1999, was a relatively new patient at the clinic and had just been declared non-contagious after a 4-week hospital stay. In Quito, he had been employed as a building contractor's assistant and worked 12 or more hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, for over 29 years. As with many immigrants before and since, economic insecurity was his major impetus for leaving Ecuador. The price of food in Quito, the price of everything, is very high. We simply could not make it in my country, so I decided I had to go to America alone, whatever the cost, to bring in more money for my family. In the late summer of 1999, Alejandro left his wife and 3 sons to begin a dangerous and illegal trip to the United States. The trip actually began months before, when he procured the services of a coyote, a nefarious travel agent who specializes in smuggling human cargo across international borders. Alejandro met the coyote through some friends in Quito, although he noted that these professionals advertise in newspapers and are relatively easy to find. Alejandro's coyote was a well-dressed, slick guy who
Sample complete. Ready to continue?